Hello and welcome to a special Christmas episode of The Album Years. Merry Christmas, everyone.
Happy Christmas.
Yes, said with extreme gusto. Yeah,
that was gusto, I thought.
Now, we have a guest. I'm going to introduce the guest in a moment. But first of all, you know, obviously, you know that our normal MO is to talk about a particular year, talk bollocks about, you know, music from a particular year. This particular episode, we're not going to do that. We're just going to talk bollocks. We're going to take stock of the podcast, because we've been running this for about, what, almost 2 years now, right, Tim?
Started at the beginning of the first lockdown. So I remember having the conversation with you, I think, in late March of 2020.
It was a lockdown project, wasn't it? It was one of those things where we kind of saw this sort of chasm of spare time opening up in front of us and thought, what are we going to fill this time with? And one of the things that you and I had discussed, I think, already was the idea of doing a podcast. And it seemed like the right time, didn't it?
Indeed. And we felt a need to spout nonsense, really.
So we're going to do that. And it seems like a lot of you out there also enjoy us spouting nonsense. So we're going to do nothing but spout nonsense on this particular episode. We're going to talk about the podcast, our experience of making it. Tim has been keeping a very, very firm eye on what you've been saying about it. And I think it's been mostly positive, hasn't it, Tim?
I'd say 95, 96%, very, very positive. And one of the things that's been really, really sweet is how many people say that we've introduced an album to them, or we've reintroduced an album to them, that it's kind of encouraged enthusiasm and discovery. And that was the whole point of the podcast, really.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing to hear, isn't it? I mean, because that, you know, at the end of the day, our kind of schoolboy enthusiasm, we're hoping that's going to kind of rub off on other people. I'm going to bring in our special guest now. Now, I think a lot of people who listen to this show will already know this guy, because he runs an amazing website called superdeluxeedition.com, which I think it's fair to say has a lot in common with this particular show in terms of the kind of people that it's appealing to. So I'm going to bring him in now. This is Paul Sinclair. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I think it's fair to say that your website, so just to explain to people who don't know about Paul's website, your website is kind of focused on, well, your tagline is holding the music in your hands. Is that right? Have I paraphrased that slightly?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. Yeah, it's very much about people that still enjoy buying physical music, because obviously a lot of people stream these days. A lot of people just don't see the value in buying music. But the website's about people who enjoy buying physical product, who enjoy buying reissues, box sets, that kind of thing.
It's more than that, though, isn't it? Because it's also about, or at least it appeals to people that I think like the idea of the album as an experience, as a listening experience. Now, this, of course, becomes this becomes increasingly, you know, out of fashion as a way of listening to music. We do live in the era of, you know, playlist culture, don't we? That kind of jukebox mentality where you don't listen necessarily to albums from beginning to end. You don't have that kind of ritual of putting on and immersing yourself in a musical continuum, a musical journey. But I think all the people that kind of follow your site, I think it's fair to say they love the idea of the album as an experience,
don't
they?
Yeah, very much so. And I think, you know, they're buying the albums that they love all over again. That's one of the things that appeals to them. Not only do they love the album, but they want to buy the same albums again and again, with the bonus tracks and the 5.1 mixes and all the rest of it. And the other thing is, you know, they love music so much. A lot of people, I've noticed, they post their pictures up of their music rooms in their house. So, you know, they've got the luxury of maybe it's the end of the lounge, or it's a separate room or whatever, but it's not just, you know, listening casually to a bit of music. It's having space, having all your records on the wall, creating an environment where you can just sit there and sort of immerse yourself in the music. And I think, you know, that's really important to a lot of SDE readers.
And is this very much a generational thing? Are we the last generation that this will be true of? Are there? I'm sure there's always the outliers, the 17-year-old kid who loves buying vinyl, but they are the outliers, aren't they? We're kind of the last generation that had that mentality.
There might be, but you've got to realise that things do change. I mean, obviously, if you think of, say, the publishing industry, up until quite recently, the Kindle was becoming incredibly dominant. And over the last 5 years, book sales, physical book sales, have increased. Streaming seems to have destroyed music, and it seems to have destroyed music in terms of form, in terms of people's ability to deep listen, in terms of musicians' ability to earn income, in a way that it hasn't with other mediums. So the film industry, you know, if Amazon Prime are, let's say, paying Mike Lee for a film exclusive, he'll be paid the same amount, if not more. His cameramen will be paid the same amount, if not more. You go into something like publishing. And again, there isn't an equivalent of streaming in literature. So you have the Kindle, which is an equivalent of a download, or at least there's a proper royalty. And it's kind of interesting, isn't it, that music has allowed itself to be the one artistic form that's absolutely been beaten by streaming and the digital age. And it kind of still astonishes me that there seems to be sort of a trashing of history. You know, if I think of No Man's work, for example, half our albums don't even have the proper release years on them. There's something really shabby about it.
I think you're absolutely right. But don't we, in a sense, live in a world now, and Paul's site is kind of testament to that, that there is more information. For the people that want it, there is more information about the sort of minutiae of making records than ever before. There are documentaries about almost every artist you could think of online. There are YouTube clips deconstructing every classic song and explaining to you what the artist did and why it's amazing. So there seems to be more obsession about those kind of details of making music than ever before. You know, and Paul, you must have seen this because your website is about 10 years old now, is it?
Yeah, 10 years, yeah.
So you must have seen, I mean, I've noticed this being someone that's kind of been involved in remixing, and you mentioned the 5.1 mixing, and now it's becoming Atmos mixing too. You must have seen this incredible explosion of the whole sort of box set phenomenon. I mean, when you started, it was probably just one or two a year, and it's now even like albums that were considered C-list albums by artists are getting this extraordinary lavish box set treatment, aren't they?
Yeah, no album is too low to be reissued as a box set in terms of, you know, what it did the first time around. But you're right, I mean the sort of the amount of knowledge and discussion that goes on online is incredible, and there's nowhere to hide anymore for the record industry that are putting out these sets. You know, everyone seems to know everything, so when it comes to making mistakes or putting the wrong version of a track or not getting something right, you know, they get a lot of negative feedback because, you know, the mechanisms are there for people to obviously go online, take part in discussions on sites like SDE or wherever, and sort of try and sort of hold the industry to account or hold the record companies to account when they get something wrong. So that's another shift that's happened. You know, in the old days, a CD would come out in 1992, there'd be a wrong track on it, and, you know, nothing would ever happen. But now, you know, there's these feedback mechanisms, and you know, and you get a lot of complaining and a lot of moaning, but yeah, for better or for worse, that's kind of where we are.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, one of the things is about streaming that sometimes you always have a reaction to that. So the production of box sets and vinyl reissues tends to be far more thorough than it was pre-streaming because you realise what you've got to compete against. It's encouraged more detail, more attention on artwork. I mean, I don't know about you, Stephen, but for me, when I'm doing an album, ever since, you know, the age of download and streaming, I've tried to do what you can't do very easily on the computer, have quite lavish covers, maybe use a string quartet if I can afford it. In other words, more detail in the sound, more detail in the way. It's actually forced me to think about what an album can be and how much I put into it. It's made me believe in it more.
I'm sure Paul will concur on this, that just doing a disc in a crystal case is no longer enough.
Yeah.
You have to think about the way you present your music. Otherwise, why would someone bother to buy a physical piece in the end, at the end of the day? So that's almost a return, isn't it, to the golden age of, you know, the beautiful vinyl and the gatefold sleeve with the inner bag and all the inserts and the novelty stuff that went, you know, that people used to really think about artwork in the sort of great era for vinyl. And then we kind of lost that with CD, which was kind of almost pseudo software in the way it was presented. It was neither one thing or the other.
But I think the music industry kind of gave up too easily on the CD. I mean, they made fortunes out of it in the 90s, and then when the sort of threat of illegal downloading and Steve Jobs and iTunes came in, instead of kind of defending it robustly, and they sort of gave up on it. And the same goes now with the so-called vinyl revival. You know, they just dumped the CD and switched to vinyl. Mm. It's a bigger margin product. They didn't, you know, I often say this, but, you know, the industry could have campaigned and worked with the motor industry to keep CD players in cars, you know, because that was the one reason people would still buy CDs, because I'm going on a long journey, I'm going to take a box of CDs and play them in the car. But they just happily let, you know, Bluetooth connections and all that take over. And there's another reason not to buy CDs. So there's a sort of short-term kind of view with the music industry. They just focus on the thing that's going to make them the most money at the moment. And they kind of did that when CDs took over from vinyl. They, you know, they bodged it up around the time of the MP3, but now they're back on the trail with vinyl, which and they, apart from box sets where you get lots of CDs in one box, they're kind of not interested in the CD. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, I think that of course they are still supporting CD, but only in this kind of multi-disc format where the price is a premium. And I suppose the other thing that you've noticed during your time running the website is the kind of normalization of things like including demos.
Yes, exactly.
And, you know, board tapes, you know, very roughly recorded live, almost, you know, taking a bootleg that's been available online or, you know, available to fans on cassettes for years and years, cleaning up and somehow selling that back to the same people that already had it on a cassette or a bootleg CD. And that's become, you know, a way of filling out these box sets, hasn't it? Kind of making them into multi-disc.
But I think CD as well, I think sometimes artists can take some responsibility because, you know, one of the things that when I first set up Burning Shed was that CDs were still selling a great deal and they were cheap to manufacture. And you found that even a lot of artists outside of the major label system would do an album, then they do the remix album, then the live album of this, then the demos. And quite often there wasn't as much, for me, quality control. It was very easy to produce these albums that would make a profit for the artist. And so I certainly think around the early 2000s, CDs were perhaps overpriced and artists exploited that by releasing material that should never have seen the light of day. And, you know, so in that sense, I think the companies are more responsible. And I think Paul's point about cars is entirely correct. But I think some artists have to take some responsibility. And you and I, Stephen, you know, we've often had this idea that the CD ushered in the destruction of the album in a way because it people were filling the space rather than making these statements. You know, format often dictates form. And as we're talking about, say, with streaming, one of the things they found is that people listening to streams now have the attention span of an average 1980s A&R person. If they've not got it in 3 or 5 seconds, they dismiss it. And it's kind of interesting that, you know, so many of the most important albums in history will be dismissed because they have slow 3 to 10 minute introductions. And I think that, you know, we have found that it is dictating form, that everything has to be a banger all the time. And this is a general, because, of course, there are some people who will still deep listen, who stream. There are some people who will still take the album seriously. I mean, I stupidly still always listen to Tusk in the way Lindsay Buckingham intended. But, you know, the point is that I will always listen to the album in the way that the artist intended.
So the other thing I wanted to say, Paul, is I love... Now, the thing is, I never read comments posted on any of my own social media, but I do read the comments that people post on your website because I find it fascinating, partly because I relate to a lot of the sort of mentality of the people that are posting there. But also, I love this idea that a box set comes out and it's centered around a particular album and there's a remaster of the album and there's a CD of demos and there's a CD or two or three or four of all the remixes that were attendant to that particular album. And I love it when people come in and they say things like, or it could have been a really good set, except they've missed off the rare remixed 7-inch that only came out in Guatemala.
Yeah.
Disaster! Won't be buying this.
Yeah, that's glass is sort of, you know, half empty kind of mentality. It's weird. Some people are just like that. They'll want to focus on the negative and not look at the positive. And you're always going to get people like that. But I think in general, certainly on my site, I mean, I do moderate it. You know, I get a bit of criticism because I moderate it quite firmly so that, you know, people can have a friendly discussion and not think they're going to get jumped on or trolled or whatever.
But it's also the box ticking thing. It's like, yeah, that got that, got that, got that, got that. Oh, that's not there. Never mind the fact that it's shit and I'm never going to listen to it. It's not included. Disaster. And I think that's, you know, that comes back to what we were talking about earlier, that these days that sort of whole phenomenon of the box set and that completism means that we're getting a lot of music and we're listening. To be fair, I do it too. I get box sets. I find myself listening to stuff that I'm not enjoying it.
I mean, the thing is, we're in the third sort of generation of some of these albums now coming out as box sets, so they have to think of something new to add. So, you know, you get kind of Bob Dylan box sets, which literally have every take of every song of, you know, of an album, because, you know, we've already had some Bob Dylan box set 10 years earlier that covered all the really important stuff. And Yeah, I mean, it's. I think it depends on the approach from the artist and from the label. I mean, some people will say, look, you know, that's shit. I don't want it on my box set. And so I'm sorry, you can't do it. Whereas other people are a bit more relaxed. And, you know, like you say, some box sets are sort of, they're all about, let's compile every single commercially released single, B-side, extra track from a 12-inch that came out at the time. And that will be the... And if that is your goal, then you have to make sure you do it right. Otherwise, the fans are going to come down on you. But if it's just kind of like, you know, here's a collection of interesting stuff from the time and we're not trying to be completely comprehensive, then I think, you know, you're okay.
I think conversely, though, some artists, you know, Kate Bush, Peter Gabriel, David Bowie, where a lot of fascinating work that actually is arguably as good as, if not better, than the album material doesn't appear on box sets. You know, I know Bowie, I remember talking in the early 90s about the fact he had two albums worth of low hero era outtakes. And I've got several outtakes from, for example, the original version of the album Outside. Quite a lot of Kate Bush, Bowie outtakes that are actually braver, more interesting. So on one level, you're right, certain artists will spew every appalling Guatemalan B-side on the box set, and then other artists, the gems completely ignored.
Well, Prince is a classic example of that, isn't he? Because in his lifetime, he didn't want anything released, really, from the vault, you know. And then once he was gone, it was kind of the flood doors opened, which was, you know, just shows you the difference.
I think... I mean, he's the exception that proves the rule. You know, the two or three artists that Tim's mentioned are kind of the exceptions that prove the rule, aren't they? But I think, you know, what I object to most is when you get those sets where you get the extra disc and you've got the big single from the record. So you've got the 7-inch edit, followed by the mono 7-inch edit, followed by the American remix, followed by the 12-inch version of the American remix. So this is the same song.
What's wrong with that, Stephen? That's brilliant, isn't it?
It's so boring.
Followed by the Spanish language version of it.
Well, I think when they're in a row, I agree. But if you can split them up and spread them out, I think it's all right.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, again, it's that box ticking thing. It's like everyone wants to have every single version. And it's not necessarily about making a satisfying listening experience, with exceptions. I mean, I'm saying you can do it, as you say, you can do these things well and you can do these things
I mean, I've
badly.
Helped put a few of these together, as you know, like Tears for Fears. And
So have I.
Yeah, exactly. But the thing I always have in my mind is that, you know, like an album like Songs from the Big Chair, Tears for Fears, you know, when that box set came out, you kind of think it's never going to come out again after this, or at least you think it's not going to. So, you know, even if this slightly kind of dodgy edit from Portugal or whatever isn't brilliant, you know, what's the harm in putting it on? Because it will, if someone somewhere wants that, you know, they've missed the opportunity and they'll never get it again, you know.
Well, the harm for us, it might just put us off it for good, that dodgy edit from Portugal.
Well, by the time you've worked your way through, you know, 55 tracks, I don't think it's going to make any difference.
But also, I would say that by the time you've worked your way through 65 tracks, you never want to hear that fucking song ever again as long as you live.
Indeed.
Because you've heard 12 different versions of it. You know, and I think that's the point. I mean, you're right, there's always something that's going to want that. Is that, I suppose the number one question really is that a good enough reason to do it? Is that good? Because for years and years and years, the artist was responsible for what they allowed out of their own vault and what they allowed out of the studio. And now it seems to me it's flipped. It's almost like the fans demand. The fans demand that they have every single take of Bob Dylan running through.
That's true. I always think the artists have had, they had their chance to do the artistic expression. They had the album, the 9-track album in 1985 or whenever it was. No, so they've sort of done that. So the box set isn't really so much about an artist trying to, do something artistic. I think it's a bit more about, you know, it's a bit more fan-centred, and it doesn't really matter, I don't think, too much if things don't flow in a kind of artistic way.
You're right, but there's also, I think we're not only talking about reissues here, there is an expectation these days, and I know as someone that's making records, and Tim, obviously the same, there is an expectation there will be a special edition from the get-go, and that special edition will include demos, instrumentals, rejects. I suppose in a way, though, I'm kind of arguing with myself here, I suppose in a way that's no different to the, you know, the old tradition of the B-side, you know, the leftover, the sort of track that didn't quite measure up that ended up on the B-side of the single or on the 12-inch single. And I used to love those things, you know, so...
I mean, your albums that have been coming out in recent years, Stephen, I mean, you know, the box set versions are effectively denying you a box set in 20 years' time because you put everything on there already.
But that is the expectation. I think people are expecting, particularly from me now, I've made a rod for my own back now. People are expecting me with every record to do a very lavish, and I love doing those things, so I'm not complaining.
But that's an interesting point, though, because that's a shift because, you know, 10 years ago, box sets primarily were about old albums coming out again. But now every new record needs to have some kind of, if not a fully blown box set, at least a kind of deluxe edition with some extra tracks on it. And that isn't something that used to happen. So that's that, because I think the record labels think, you know, there will be no 20th anniversary box set of whatever this new album is. So we've got to sort of make the most of it now, you know.
So we talked about the comments on your website, Paul. So Tim now has been compiling all of the negative comments, particularly about me. He really enjoys telling me about something negative that somebody said about me.
I can't believe there's any negative comments, surely.
Well, apparently there has been. But anyway, we're going to ignore the negative comments. But Tim, you've compiled some...
Yeah, I've compiled. I do always tell Stephen what's been said about him and me. Generally speaking, as I said, 96%, extremely lovely, very positive. So it's been a joy to do, and the response
has
been fantastic.
But of course, a lot of the comments are about our terrible schoolboy errors that we make frequently, aren't they?
I thought you threw them in deliberately, Stephen, you know, just sort of...
Well, sadly not, no. I made a terrible, terrible error in the last episode, Songs from the Beehive by David Sylvian. And do you know, the first person that alerted me to the terrible error was Richard Barbieri. He was straight on text message to tell me that I'd made a terrible, terrible schoolboy error. So I do hang my head in shame, but there is always a few. Now, Tim edited all of his own out of the last episode.
I don't want the mask of expertise to slip.
So what other schoolboy errors have the listeners picked up on, or what other comments have they had over the last week or so?
To be honest with you, I've not done it. What I've done this time, we asked via your Facebook and my Facebook questions they would like to ask us about the show. And one, I think it's kind of an interesting idea, Thomas Barthelmius says, I'd love you to do deep dives into your favourite drinking game artists. Do a whole episode on each, and then maybe a deep dive into what specifically inspired you while working together on your collaborative albums, e.g. No Man.
The artists that have become sort of part of the drinking game, if correct me if I'm wrong, Tim, are Fripp.
Yeah.
Sylvian, is he one?
He's in there. Eno,
he's in there.
Talk Talk.
Eno, Talk Talk. What about The Ham? The Ham?
The Ham gets in a few of them. I'm surprised that Kate Bush and Bowie and Floyd haven't, because they do get mentioned.
Well, I'd love to do a whole episode dedicated to one of those artists, but only if people will continue the drinking game. So if we do a whole episode on, say, Robert Fripp, you must drink a shot every time we mention Robert Fripp.
See, I will be the only one who will be sober because I haven't drunk since I was 18.
So, just order the ambulance before the show begins, yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so what other comments have we got, or questions have we got? Maybe something that Paul can chip
in
on.
Yeah, well, Paul will like this one. He'll love this. Chris Tig says, further discussion of McCartney 2 would be most welcome.
Well, now, I was going to say that what we should do today is we should also go back and maybe review some of our own discussions about some of these albums. And perhaps we've been a bit unfair about some of them. Now, Paul, I remember you when you listened to the very first podcast, you said to me, I think I could have made a better defence of McCartney 2 than Tim did on our first episode.
Can I? Right, Paul, thanks for your criticism. Thank you. Anyway, no. I actually edited out, because I did a lot of editing on that as well. And basically, I spoke for probably, and we do this a lot. When Stephen and I do this podcast, we can often speak for about 3 or 4 hours. And so the McCartney 2 discussion was about 10 times longer. And I just kind of cut it out because partly I'd not said what I wanted to say about it. But I was more vociferous and articulate in its defence than is heard. And I think we just left it as it was, for comedy value.
You're a very, 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 very poor apologist for Paul McCartney.
I don't remember saying that, Stephen, anyway. I think Stephen's just winding you up there. But what have you got against Paul McCartney, Stephen Wilson? That's what I want to know.
I don't have anything against
Paul. Have you said anything positive about him in any of your
Nothing.
Podcasts?
Well, the thing is, okay, right, we've only talked about McCartney 2, right? and Press to Play, an album which I've not even heard, okay? Now, I have read your book on Press to Play, and it doesn't make me want to go and listen to it, Paul, I've got to say.
Well, the funny thing is, Press to Play, I've actually got a bone to pick with Tim here, because he said Press to Play is better than Tug of War, which is one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard said about
McCartney. Somebody else actually said, in what universe is Press to Play better than Tug of War? And I said, well, mine, clearly. I just kind of like its artificial art pop wankery, if that makes any sense. Tug of War, to me, didn't have the majesty or creativity or insanity of some of his 70s albums. You know, I quite like London Town, you know.
Tug of War has that craft work, that songwritery craft work. I mean, it does have the George Martin production, which makes it maybe sound a little bit old-fashioned or whatever, but... Press to Play is a load of average songs sort of layered with Hugh Padgham production. And once you take the production away, which I do enjoy that kind of mid-80s production, but once you take it away, there's not actually that much there left.
I would agree, but this is my, you know, Press to Play, you've opened your drawer and there's a whole load of really fascinating green goop in there. With Tug of War, you've opened the next drawer and it's kind of cardboard ironed underpants.
A nice metaphor.
Yeah.
I think I need to disabuse you guys of the notion that I've got something against Paul McCartney. Macca. Okay, listen, my favourite Beatles song is essentially a Paul McCartney solo performance, Blackbird. Okay?
Beautiful.
I love McCartney 1. If we've been talking about McCartney 1, I love it. Maybe I'm Amazed, one of the greatest songs ever written by anyone, mm-hmm. I think. McCartney 2 is just not very good.
No. Coming up. From McCartney too. I think Coming Up is stands, you know, with any of his post-Beatles solo work. I think Coming Up is one of the best songs he's ever written after the Beatles.
Waterfalls, it's the new Long and Winding Road.
McCartney won. I mean, it's a charming album and he's still got the kind of shadow of the Beatles and he's there playing his bass and his piano in Abbey Road or wherever. But McCartney too is Paul kind of experimenting, you know, learning how to play early sequencers, synthesizers. I mean, and sort of succeeding. And it's not really a mess. It's a creative, experimental, commercial success, which is
inventing
amazing.
Drum and bass, Stephen.
Coming Up got John Lennon out of the studio recording Double Fantasy. I mean, you know, that's how good it was.
I think I was slightly against it from the beginning because Tim was making such preposterous claims for it, as he just has again there, that McCartney 2 invented drum and bass.
I think Goldie, Ronnie Size, they still cite it as the key album.
I think if you listen to Check My Machine, which is a B-side from that record, that's like Gorillaz sort of 25 years earlier.
Oh, no, you're doing it too now. Look, I would be the first to admit it's got some lovely songs on it. Waterfalls is indeed lovely. Coming Up is a great pop song. Band on the Run, great album. Ram, masterpiece. I'm just not really... What about McCartney 3, Paul? Have you got anything to say about McCartney 3?
I do quite like it, but I think the sad fact is Paul McCartney's voice just... You know,
it's gone.
It's no longer the wonderful instrument it once was, and so therefore he doesn't create the melodies that he once created. And I think, you know, I did enjoy the record. I actually really liked the remix version as well that came out. But the sad thing is, you know, you can't. Every time a new McCartney album is announced, you're measuring your expectations. You're lowering them a little bit because you just know that, you know, his days are gone a bit.
I think he's one of those artists a bit, and in this case, there are parallels between him and people like Neil Young and Lou Reed while he was still alive, and Bowie also, is that I think every time they release an album, the fan base is desperate to proclaim it a return to form, aren't they? And that desperation, I think, sometimes makes you listen through rose-tinted ears, if such a thing is possible.
I know. I mean, there's a wonderful track at the end of McCartney 3 called When Winter Comes. And I listened to the whole album and thought, yeah, this is pretty good in places. It's, you know, it's experimental. It's interesting. He has to do a bit more interesting things because he can't craft a brilliant pop song in the way that he used to. So it's quite experimental and quite nice. But then at the end, there was this song called When Winter Comes. And it was beautiful and his voice was beautiful. And I was thinking, wow, you know, I was almost brought me to tears listening to how good it was. And then I realised it was an old song from 1992 that he'd shoved on the end of the record. And it was kind of like, well, OK, I understand why that sounds so good now, because it's the Paul McCartney of nearly 30 years ago.
But I think some artists manage to work with their ageing voices. So people like Johnny Cash, Leonard Cohen, Scott Walker, you know, their later works were as good as their earlier works. And arguably, Bob Dylan, in a sense, ageing hasn't necessarily ravaged his voice. He never had a singer's voice, and he's managed to make ageing work for him. And I think it's kind of interesting that McCartney had such a sweet, beautiful voice that perhaps that's one of the issues.
All the touring he's been doing over the last decade, you know, he doesn't seem to change the key of the songs that he sings. And I don't really think that's helped very much, to be honest, with his voice.
I mean, there are certain singers, aren't there, where age makes no difference. Tom Waits, Neil Young, they sounded like 70-year-old men at the beginning of their career. So, I mean, in that sense, I suppose McCartney had a lot more to lose.
I mean, it's very cruel, I think, that, you know, the way that, you know, singers and songwriters lose their voice. And yeah, I mean, I know it's just Mother Nature and time and everything, but it's a cruel blow when that gets taken away from you, I think.
True, but it doesn't always happen. And obviously we're seeing with an artist like Nick Cave, where actually his work, he's grown into it, I think, as he's developed as an artist. In his 60s, he's arguably more creative than he was in his 30s. Quite a lot of people were asking us about favourite albums that we give to one another as gifts, and also what our favourite Christmas recordings are. We had quite a lot of those. Somebody here, Steve Fincham, says, have either of you walked into a record shop, heard some music playing in the shop, and immediately thought, I have to buy this, and walked out with the album?
Not for many years, I have to say, but certainly, in my record-buying days in the 80s, very, very often, even through the 90s. Yeah, I can't remember specific things, but yeah.
I can think, well, 2000s, I remember specifically, bizarrely, I think it was Virgin in Norwich. And I think one was Sigur Rós, and I can't even pronounce it, Sveni Englar, which I think was there. And I heard that in the shop and was utterly blown away, had to buy it. And the next week I went in and they played the Golf Rap, Lovely Head, which again, absolutely floored me in the shop, and had to get, you know, in both those cases.
I remember hearing Consolidated's Tool or Die in that record shop in Manchester, Tim. They had the basement with all the cheap records in it. You must have.
Yeah,
and immediately buying that. Anyway, what about you, Paul? Last time you were in a record shop, heard something and couldn't resist buying it.
I can't really remember, but I'm like you, Stephen, I'm sure I did it. You know, you used to go to the front of Our Price and they'd have the little CD case on there, wouldn't they? Showing you the album that they were playing. But yeah, I mean, it's been so long. It's a shame, really, that doesn't sort of exist in the same kind of way, other than obviously the independent network of record shops.
Well,
is the equivalent now
hearing seeing something on YouTube, or getting a text message from a friend and saying, check this band out, and you follow the link and you hear the music. And I don't know about you, if I hear something I like on YouTube, I immediately tend to go and buy the album. You know, that's just the way I work.
I think that's probably. I think that's true. And also on the Super Deluxe Edition website, people are always recommending things to other people. And that kind of community spirit, I think, is, you know, wonderful.
Okay, another comment or question, Tim?
Well, here's one I can't answer, but you two might be able to. Two-parter, have you watched Get Back yet? And what are your thoughts about Peter Jackson's Sonic Restorations? This is from DC Daily. And I think it'd be fascinating for both of you to compare and contrast the George Martin and Giles Martin approaches to albums, where, you know, I do have those, so I could kind of comment, but I've not seen
it. I have not either. So, Paul, have you seen it?
I have seen it, yes, and I think it's amazing. I mean, a lot of people have said, oh, it's too long, 8 hours, you know, it's boring, but I think it's possibly the best document that we're ever going to get in terms of, like, how the Beatles worked together and operated together as a band. You know, so obviously it's near the end, but I thought it was absolutely fascinating. And the thing is, having all the kind of, in quotation marks, boring stuff where they're trying to work out songs, you know, you need that, because when they get to the end and they're on the rooftop or they're finishing off a song, it means something then, because you've sat through all the... You know, you've basically been in the position of the band members. You've been sort of trying to understand what's going on, what's good, what's bad about this song. and then you see the final product at the end. I think it's amazing, absolutely amazing.
Well, I think as well, what's kind of amazing about it is how young they were, because I don't think any of them were in their 30s at that stage. And you think of how they'd gone from being a kind of a rock and roll covers band in Liverpool to this, you know, the birth of Merseybeat, and then, you know, via Help, Sergeant Pepper's, Abbey Road. I mean, the growth of the musicians over an astonishingly short period of time. That's the thing that always gets me about the Beatles.
I mean, exactly. This was January 1969. So, you know, if you go back 5 years, you know, they hadn't even gone to America and sort of had a hit with I Want to Hold Your Hand, which is sort of unbelievable when you think of it in those terms.
Yeah.
The other thing I got from that documentary was just the sadness of how it all deteriorated, because you know, what Peter Jackson has done is he's reframed that whole era. And, you know, and it sounded like hype at the beginning. Oh, they were really happy. They weren't arguing. And you kind of thought, really? I'm not sure I believe that. But actually, it's true. You know, John Lennon was very funny. Yoko was sitting there, not really annoying anyone. Just a bit weird that she was there. But, you know, she wasn't annoying anyone, or, you know, really sort of stopping them doing what they wanted to do. And I think it was the Alan Klein thing that really was the big thing that ended up sort of making it go downhill. But it looked and felt as if there was another few Beatles albums at least, you know.
Well, I think sometimes with bands falling apart, you know, and Stephen and I know this from experience with a lot of bands falling apart, it's often when people don't talk, they don't communicate. You know, if you look at, say, the disintegration of the Smiths, it seems that people were spreading rumours behind the scenes, and Morrissey and Marr, for whatever reason, couldn't discuss it. And I think, you know, one of the good things I've always liked about working with Stephen is that actually both of us have always been incredibly honest and open. So I won't go into it, but we had an industry manager who actually at one point tried to be very divisive, and actually both of us just talked to one another outside of this. And I remember him saying, I hate you two. You're the only two people I've ever worked with who actually talk. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it seems to happen so often in bands. It's unbelievable. And I think as soon as individual band members get different management, people looking after their affairs, then I think you're in trouble. And that's effectively what happened. You know, Paul had John Eastman, Linda's dad. John and the others went with Alan Klein. And that was a divisive path that, you know, ultimately split them up, I think.
Yeah, and I think you're right. Okay, more questions. Okay, this is somebody here asked about 17 questions, but I'll get his first two. This is Shane Borger, or Borgia. And he goes, Stephen, how do you really feel about Genesis? And then he says, make sure that Tim tells us his story about buying Foxtrot again. So I went into Warrington Rumbelows and I got Angelic Upstart, so I'm an upstart.
Oh,
Genesis,
not that
Foxtrot
story again. Oh, my God. I think there's a perception that I actually actively dislike them. I don't. I quite like them. I think there was almost like this automatic expectation that I must love Genesis because I am, you know, so immersed in that world of progressive rock.
Yeah, you're the Prince of Prog.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and actually, there's a lot of progressive rock that I'm fairly ambivalent about. There's some I quite like, and there's some I love. And the bands I loved were Floyd, King Crimson, and Yes, I love Yes. And there were bands I quite liked. Genesis would have been one of those bands. I don't have all the records. And actually, I'm quite fond of some of the more pop-orientated stuff. There's an album called And Then There Were Three that I think has got some really beautiful songs on it.
Very sweet. Yeah. Well, we're going to do 1978 next. And I think there are going to be quite a few albums like that that are unexpected. I think both of us quite like. Plus, a few indefensible albums that I'm prepared to defend. So the next one could be something of a fight, I think, the podcast.
Right, okay. But, look forward to that one then.
We shall see. A few people asked us about our collection. So Penny Reynolds, for example, and Klaus Paulsen. And it was, how is your personal record collection catalogued? And also, how many do you have?
Oh, Paul can answer the question too. I don't know how many records I've got. I'm going to guess probably not as many as people might think. I've probably got a couple of thousand. Alphabetically, that's all. I don't separate. We're getting into real nerd territory here. I don't separate genre because I don't recognise the concept of genre. And there's always that problematic artist that you can't say whether they're this or that. You know, is Mahavishnu Orchestra a rock band, or are they a jazz band?
Well, I mean, I go for mine is alphabetical, and within that, chronological within the alphabetical. And I know exactly what I've got, because it's all, because I think, you know, when I first knew you, I think I had a couple of thousand LPs, and because of moving across London and so on, that became zero LPs. And obviously I went the way of the CD. And what's quite funny is that I probably have the same amount now that I had 20 years ago. So I've got about 1,000 CDs, 100 CD box sets, and now probably a couple of hundred vinyl. So it's actually quite small. And partly for me, it's because I constantly reassess what I like, why I like it, what's the reason for me keeping this. So in a sense, although I constantly, you know, I still buy CDs, I still buy vinyl, I reassess to the point where actually my collection probably hasn't grown for the last
I mean, particularly about over the last year, I probably got rid of half my box sets, because this goes back to what we were talking about earlier with Paul, is that I look at a lot of them and I think I'm never going to listen to 90% of the content of this box set, and it just they take up so much space, don't they, Paul? I can't imagine how many box sets you must have and how much space they take up
now
in your house.
Paul's neck is bent double because there are so many box sets
pressing down
in
on
that
you.
Room. Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to use the word hoarder, Paul, but
life laundry, Paul. Well, life laundry.
I mean, yeah, you do have to be careful. I mean, there is there's that thin line between collecting records and being a hoarder on one of those programs on ITV. You know? So, I mean, for the record, mine's all in alphabetical, chronological within that. But the problem is, it's not all in one place. So this alphabetical thing falls apart when you've got piles in the lounge and piles in the office and piles in the bedroom, you know. So it gets quite complicated. But yeah, I mean, I think sometimes I look at things and think, when was the last time I played that record? If it was over 5 years ago, you know, is it earning its keep? You know, is it paying its rent by being in that space? That's sort of, and so sometimes I take things to the, I took a load of 12-inch singles to the charity shop recently because I thought, it was actually a load of Alison Moyet 12-inch singles, He Whispers. But I was thinking, well, you know, I've got the deluxe CD of this ALF album, you know. It had all the mixes on it. Do I need, you know, 2 inches of Alison Moyet 12-inch mixes in my collection?
But the problem with that philosophy, Paul, is you take it to its ultimate extreme and you just end up with an iPhone with all your music on it, don't you? Because that takes up the least amount of space of all. But I'm playing devil's advocate here, because I completely understand where you're coming from.
The problem is, you know, everyone has a finite amount of space, and you can't just, you know, buy everything and collect everything and have everything, because it's not physically possible to do.
People do. I mean, one of my cousins, it's interesting, he saw my record collection when I was a teenager, was absolutely entranced by it. He has 20,000 LPs.
Yeah. I don't think...
Which is...
Where are these? I mean, where does he store
apparently
these?
They take up his entire second floor, the second floor of his house.
Well, that's Michael from Opeth as well. His entire living room is basically just LPs. I don't know how his girlfriend puts up with it. But anyway, the point is, I suppose, is that I can't think... I probably couldn't think of 20,000 LPs. And I consider myself someone that has very eclectic taste. I couldn't think of 20,000 records that I genuinely really like or love. So in that case, I'm imagining that among those 20,000 LPs is a lot of stuff that your cousin doesn't actually like that much, but they have it because it completes a collection. It's the completism gene.
Yeah, I mean, for example, yeah. I think my albums.
Well, absolutely.
They'll be in his collection for that reason.
Exactly. That's exactly why I've got your albums, yeah.
But the other point here is, you know, record companies are producing 8 different coloured vinyl copies of McCartney 3. And so Paul McCartney fans... Yeah, the obsessive ones are thinking, well, I've got to buy that 8 times now. So therefore, you know, it takes up more space and you're buggered. To be fair to the music industry, they're trying to give exclusives to certain retailers in certain territories, and that they're not necessarily saying, hey, Paul McCartney fans, you need to buy 8 copies. But of course, you know, because of the internet, it's quite easy to get hold of things these days. There's no barriers anymore. So people go off and do it and then blame the record companies for making them spend so much money.
Another thing that isn't kind of discussed very often, but there have been increasingly articles on it in The Guardian, for example, that environmentally, streaming is actually worse than vinyl production and CD production at their peak combined.
Right.
I would happily go back a few steps in terms of technology. I would happily forego streaming, forego my Netflix, if this had an environmental impact. It seems counterintuitive, doesn't it, that physical production, so even physical production of vinyl at its peak in the 70s and CD at its peak in the 90s, combined is less than the environmental impact of streaming because of the power required for servers. This is according to certain research. And it is sort of interesting that this isn't discussed more widely, to me, anyway, especially at this point in history.
Very interesting, yeah.
No, I mean, I think the power of convenience, you can't underestimate it. I mean, that's, you know, in the 90s, I used to go around to friends' houses and it was all about what amplifier have you got, what speakers have you got, what setup have you got. And of course, MP3s come in and all that goes out the window because I'd rather have 5,000 songs in my pocket, thanks very much, you know.
So Lyndon Garrett, love the show, but with all the production skills you both possess, why does Tim always sound like he's recording in the toilet? Now, I've got the answer to this one, that basically the first few shows, and hopefully the last couple will be all right, the ones in between were all done in my outbuilding. Now, when I record my vocals in my outbuilding, I've got this Isovox 2 and my Neumann mic inside it, so you get pristine sound. But unfortunately, it's got a vaulted ceiling, so it actually does sound like a 19th century toilet.
Yeah, you do have the well, you had a period where you were still building your studio, didn't you? So you didn't have the soundproofing
in. And then when it was built, it sounds even worse.
Yeah.
But obviously, when I'm doing my vocals, I've got the Isovox, so obviously it sounds absolutely fine. So I'm doing this in the house. Hopefully it's going to be slightly better. And the reason I don't do it in the house normally is because we've got, like you, Stephen, we've got a dog downstairs. We've got Birdie, who can be loud. And then also an 11-year-old child who can burst in screaming. So this is why I do it in the 19th century toilet.
Right, right. You see, all the same things that McCartney had to put up with when he was doing McCartney 1 and 2 at home, in his home studio.
Yeah, exactly. Quite a few people asking us what our albums of the year are. Also, what our favourite year for music and least favourite year for music. That's Andreas Hare. So albums of this year...
Floating Points, Pharoah Sanders.
Yeah, the Floating Points, Pharoah Sanders, I think is great. Grass Cut, Over Winter, I think is a lovely album. Got to say the Damon Albarn album, I think is fantastic. The new one, I think it's one of his best. And Milkbone, Matt Berry, I think his new trio is a very lovely album. Elbow's album, I liked.
Matt Berry's Blue Elephant came out this year too, I think, didn't it? Maybe early on in the year.
Okay.
Yes, there you go. Paul's holding up. That's a great record too, yeah.
Yeah, it was this year. I had that in my list, yeah. I think that was amazing.
Clark was all right, if you know that one, Playground in a Lake. And Modern Nature, especially in terms of packaging, I think the Modern Nature album was fantastic, if you know that.
I don't know, no. Paul, what about you?
I really liked the new Crowded House album. Dreamers Are Waiting, it's called. It's their first album for about 10 years, but... You know, I mean, they split up in 1996, of course, and went away and then came back. But it's been ages, I think, since the last brilliant Crowded House album. But this new one is absolutely amazing.
Okay, so wow.
It's a wonderful record, but I don't think it really did anything. It just sort of came and went. But
Which is odd, given their status, really, isn't it?
Well, I know. I think lockdown and COVID and all that, they were supposed to tour and then that got postponed. And I don't think that helped, but... It's a real shame because, I mean, you know, Neil Finn is such a master songwriter and you know, Mitchell Froom's in the band now. It's a bit of a family thing going on. They've got his sons, Liam and Elroy, in the band. And it's a wonderfully kind of crafted album, but there's a lot of atmosphere and texture to it. So I'd really highly recommend that.
To be fair, Paul, just picking up on something you just said, isn't that true of most albums? They just come and go very quickly. Now, the turnover is very quick. I think most artists that come from, you know, what you would call legacy artists that have been going for a few years now, their albums come out, the fan base buy them, they disappear off the face of the earth.
It's very depressing. I mean, unless you're sort of Queen's greatest hits, ABBA Gold, Adele, Taylor Swift, or you know, all these sort of artists, then... Yeah, I guess that is the case. And I really sort of mourn the death of the single in that respect because, you know, releasing 4 or 5 physical singles from an album, you know, gave an album a lifespan.
Right.
And you gave it time to breathe. And whereas it just doesn't, obviously that doesn't happen anymore. And you get a few videos on YouTube, it comes out. And as you say, it kind of disappears the next week.
Everything is oriented towards that pre-order, really.
And I think that's a real shame, because you know, in the old days, you might have, you know, one, maybe two singles, you know, and it wasn't enough to spoil the enjoyment of the actual journey of a record. But I think if there's too much comes out beforehand, that's very annoying, I think.
I think part of the problem, I mean, I had this with the Future Bites, and part of the problem was, of course, it got delayed. So we had to fill the void with something. And I think I ended up releasing four or five of the songs before the album came out. So half the album was familiar by the time people got it. But also, I think part of the problem now is the lead time between an announcement for a record and the actual release gets longer and longer and longer. Like, for example, we've just announced the new Porcupine Tree record, and it's coming out in June next year, and it was announced in October. So what are we going to do? We're going to have to fill that. We're going to keep momentum, fill that time now. And of course, a lot of that is down to the vinyl manufacturing lead times now. Yeah. So yeah, 8 months between finishing an album, at least eight months between finishing it and actually being able to release it. It's insane.
Yeah, crazy. Yeah.
Well, the funny thing is my solo album's coming out a week before the Porcupine Tree. It's not been announced yet, but Stephen was mixing and mastering both at the same time. And he was working to a kind of October, early November deadline for both of us to get this kind of late June release.
Okay, Tim, another question maybe? Another question?
Okay. I mean, obviously people were asking us about our favourite reissues of this year. For me, not that much this year. I mean, I think the Jethro Tull reissue programme continued really nicely. Benefit was this year. And I think they've done a fantastic job in terms of the detail in sleeve notes, the detail in imagery, and being very generous with presenting the album as it should be, plus the extras and live extras. So I think that's been a fantastic series. And I know you've been a part of this, Stephen. Vinyl, Montgolfier Brothers, 17 Stars. There was a reissue on a small indie label. It's just a beautiful version of a beautiful album.
Paul, what about you with reissues? I know we're kind of preempting what I'm sure you'll do on your website here slightly, but...
it's fine. I mean, the big one for me was this stands head and shoulders above everything else, and that's the Plastic Ono Band reissue, John Lennon. I thought that was incredible what they did with that record, you know. There was just six CDs of... I mean, normally, to go back to what you were saying earlier on, Stephen, I mean, you kind of think, do you need that much? But because it's John Lennon, because it's his first proper solo album, I mean, it was just incredible, you know. He did 94 takes of the song Mother, you know. And they weren't all on... they weren't all on right. there, but, you know, that just shows you the sort of...
Only 92 were on.
Because I always thought of that album as, you know, he went in, he did it, he came out, and it was kind of done in 5 minutes. But, you know, he took his time, and he really spent a lot of time and energy on that record. And the way that they presented that particular box set, you know, they just... It was absolutely amazing. They had these things called element mixes where... They would go back to the master tapes, and if there was some bit of organ that they chose not to put in the original song, they'd bring that up and sort of show you what that sounded like, what could have been but wasn't, that kind of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And then they had the raw studio mixes where it was less polished, and they had these evolution mixes, which were like mini documentaries where it went through every stage of the recording process. It started off with the kind of scratchy demo and then ended up with the sort of finished song.
Just to play devil's advocate here, and going back to our discussion earlier, is there a lot of that stuff you would listen to more than once, do you think?
Well, I mean, I found myself listening to it a lot at the time. I haven't listened to it for a while because it came out back in April, but it's there to sort of dip into, and it's such an important kind of record. I mean, that album, it took me years to realise that album even existed. As a sort of teenager, I knew about Imagine in 1971. Everyone sort of knew about that. My dad used to own that record, so we had that in the house. But this kind of missing album, there's no singles in the UK from the Plastic Ono Band album. So it was kind of a weird thing to discover in my early 20s. And I've always loved the rawness of that record.
It's a great album. And I think it's interesting you talk about the raw production. That, you know, the Beatles obviously were known for increasingly sophisticated production, certainly around the 67 period. But the George Harrison, All Things Must Pass, and obviously McCartney, these were very raw albums as well. And it was kind of interesting that the Beatles themselves sort of rejected the ornate, innovative productions.
Okay, cool.
I just wanted to mention, actually, sorry, Stephen, I just wanted to mention it's halfway house between a reissue and a new record, but that was the Prince reissue, Welcome to America. And that was a kind of unreleased album that, that came out sort of in the middle part of this year. And I thought that was just incredible because it was recorded in 2010 between two fairly average Prince albums that came out, which one of them was called 2010 and the other one was called Plectrum Electrum. So the, this was the sort of hole in the middle. And it's a wonderful sort of organic sounding sort of 70s kind of funky kind of album. And, you know, and it's typical Prince, this genius record, which is a sort of has a great theme to it, you know, sort of socio-economic kind of lyrics. And it was just hidden away. And so that was wonderful to see that, I thought.
I agree. Yeah. My kind of idea of a really nice box set these days is one that kind of compiles catalogues. So I really like the box set of the Seafeel stuff from the Warp Records, Seafeel Records from the 90s, Rupt and Flex, which came out, which is basically just all of the work they actually put out officially on the label. So there's no outtakes. Well, there's a couple, but very, very little in the way of outtakes or leftovers. It's just a lot of music, which I didn't have, kind of all compiled in a really nice package. And I really like the reissue of Square Pusher's Feed Me Weird Things on triple vinyl, folks, as well. Ooh. There we go. So proper drum and bass, Tim, not that fake McCartney.
No, I think Square Pusher did actually say McCartney too. I think he put it up there alongside Ferris Anders, Miles Davis, Eno as being a big
influence on his sound, yeah.
Jim Patton, and I'm sure we can all answer this one. Have you ever bought an album by a band or artist you didn't know purely because you liked the cover artwork and presentation?
Oh, I'm sure I must have done. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing, isn't it? That was the other thing about going to a record store, wasn't it? Is that you could sort of, you could pick up the records and see the artwork and sometimes even just the credits would make you interested in an album, yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh, Mellotron!
I mean,
Mellotron, let's get that one. yes. Yeah, certainly. I can't think of examples, but yes, certainly I would have done that in the olden days.
I think I've done that as well. But,
any 23 envelope cover is like, oh my God, I have to own this. And Hypnosis were kind of similar in a way that there's something quite enigmatic that drew you in. And you are right as well. When you looked at the back of certain sleeves and you saw certain instruments, you know, the dulcimer was that selling
point. Fender Rhodes. If it's a jazz record from the early 70s, Fender Rhodes. Yeah, that will always do. Sorry, Paul, you were going to say.
I was just going to agree, really. I artwork is so important. And that's one of the sad things, I think, about, you know, online streaming and even with CDs, just that compression of the artwork. Sometimes they'll rejig artwork for CDs, so it's not even the proper album cover. I'm sure I've done that plenty of times.
So I was about to say that what's interesting is sometimes it's some of my favourite artists have got some of my least favourite sleeves. So Blue Nile, for example, you know, remain one of my favourite artists of all time. And I think almost all of their albums are indispensable, all four of them. But I don't think they've ever had good cover artwork. You know, perhaps A Walk Across the Rooftops is atmospheric, and that's about as much as you can say.
Well, that's interesting, because I've noticed a trend for basically shit artwork on new albums these days. I don't, you know, whether it's Sting or, you know, whoever, but it's kind of like they just can't be bothered. It just gets phoned in because they know it's going to be a thumbnail on a Spotify or whatever.
I think you're 100% right, and I think it also, if you look at advertising on YouTube or a lot of advertising on television, it's infinitely poorer. You know, in the 70s, 80s, 90s, even up to the early 2000s, some of the best creative minds would be involved in advertising because there was a lot of money.
Also, I remember thinking the Talk covers were always very underachieving for me in terms of the quality of the music. I remember it was slightly disappointing.
Yes, I agree.
You know, I mean, the last two albums basically had the same cover, didn't they? Laughing Stock and Spiravine. So couldn't they have, you know, such an extraordinary record that he's obviously sweated tears of blood to make, and that's the best he can come up with? Oh, let's just have the same cover as we had last time.
But I think, you know, I mean, we know this because, I mean, Stephen and I were managed by Talk Talk's management, and I don't think they were interested.
No.
So basically, James Marsh and the manager, Keith Aspdon, they defined the look of the band. And I think it shows because I don't think there's a particular connect. You know, the imagery I don't mind. I think James Marsh is a fantastic illustrator and the covers work. But I don't think they necessarily work with the music. They seem entirely separate entities. And the same with Blue Nile, I guess, that they just put everything into the music. It's like, okay, that's your job to the design department, Stylo Rouge or whoever was doing it. Whereas I think you and I tend to, from the beginning, you know, one of the stories that people probably don't know is that Love You to Bits, for example, from No Man, That was, I think, the 100th image that Carl had come up with. I don't think he'd ever had anything quite as bad as that. But you and I do tend to be quite difficult and quite obsessive when it comes to artwork.
There's no question there are certain labels that still seem to care very much about presentation artwork. I think of that label Ghostbox, or even, you know, labels like Warp Records that use people like the Designers Republic.
Yeah, yeah.
But certainly the majors seem to be allocating less and less money to packaging and presentation. Unless, ironically enough, unless it's a big reissue box set, and then they're quite happy to spend the money because they know that the price tag of that box set will justify the extra money they're spending on design and artwork. Let's have one more question, maybe, Tim, and then try wrap
one
up.
More. I'll ask you a really quick question here from Jonathan Ayala. Why don't you guys ever mention hip-hop albums? Is it that you're not familiar with the genre, or that you aren't generally fans?
I think right from the beginning, myself and Tim said that we would talk about albums which we are personally invested in, you know. We're not going to cover musical genres that we're not familiar with. And I think the bottom line is that neither myself or Tim listened to a lot of hip-hop music. At least the only time I did was in the very early 90s. I really enjoyed stuff like Tribe Called Quest and De La Soul. But I'm not familiar with that world. And I have nothing against it, but I just don't know that music. I cannot talk with any authority about it. So I think it's better to stick with what, you know, we've kind of stuck with what we know, haven't we, Tim?
To a degree, yeah, which hopefully is eclectic. I mean, for me, a little like you, I think late 80s, early 90s hip-hop. I mean, for me, it was more listening to it from a production point of view. I kind of loved the way in which hip-hop artists would mash genres together. You know, the sample culture I found really inspiring, and often would put really unexpected samples up against one another, and in quite an unmusical way. You know, one of my favourite artists of the 90s was Tricky. And I think Tricky, in a way, was quite unmusical, but because of that was incredibly innovative because of what he'd put together in terms of his soundscapes and samples.
You know, we were very clear right from the beginning this would be a very, very personal perspective on the music world from us, yeah.
Yeah, although I think we've missed, I mean, one of the things, again, that, you know, as I was saying, we often do four-hour broadcasts and miss out an awful lot. You know, actually, we've listened to more than we discuss, and often in a given year, you know, I'm kind of amazed that, say, 1992, I realised one of my favourite albums from that year, Suzanne Vega, that was left out. A Mitchell Froom produced recording, 99.9 Fahrenheit Degrees, was that it? Which I thought was brilliant.
Did we not talk about that?
We didn't. No, we'd forgotten it in the last podcast, 1986, because there's so much. A Certain Ratio's Force, which is a favourite album for me that year.
We talked about A Certain Ratio on another episode at least, though, didn't we? Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think sometimes we ignore albums and artists from a certain year because we've already given them too much airtime. Obviously not the Drinking Game artists, which we've got to mention, even if they're not released an album that year. We've got to mention it.
Oh, Robert Fripp did this and he did that, didn't
well,
he?
Well, he's a bit of a tart. He does tend to pop up on a lot of records.
Anyway, here, Toby Little. This could be a good end question, if you want, which is, you're both marooned on a desert island, bizarrely, with a very good hi-fi setup and electricity. You can only have one album from each decade, from the 60s to the present day. But here's the catch. You've got to share the album from each decade. You don't get to choose one each.
Wow. Do we include Paul?
It's a bit like Squid Game, isn't it? It's a bit like Squid Game.
Do we include Paul in this too? Because it could be tricky to get three.
Okay. No, leave me out of it.
Well, you know what? Look, Paul would dismiss all of the decades and to say, right, I've got this equipment, McCartney 2.
McCartney 2, yeah.
That's what he'd say. And, exactly. I wouldn't blame him. McCartney 2, possibly London Town.
He might say Press to Play.
I listened to Press to Play,
part of the reason I quite liked it as well was because I'd not heard it necessarily.
Can we shut up? Can we shut up about Paul McCartney?
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Mecca!
We'll have to talk. We'll have to take Flowers in the Dirt offline because I've got a lot to say about that record.
Okay, listen. Right, well, Tim, what are we going to do? So we 60s. 60s. Is there an album we can agree on? In a Silent Way, Miles Davis. That's my first volley across the bow. In a Silent Way, Miles Davis.
I was going to go for Scott 3 or Five Leaves Left.
Piper at the Gates of Dawn. Oh, Five Leaves Left. Yeah, Five Leaves Left. Scott 3.
Sketches of Spain.
Sketches of Spain. Well, only just in the 60s. Not In a Silent Way. Okay, let's go with Five Leaves Left, In a Silent Way. And what was the other one you said that I kind of agreed with?
Oh, Scott 3?
Scott 3.
Well, you prefer Scott 4, don't you?
I do. Would I want to listen to Scott Walker's voice ad infinitum for the rest of eternity? That's the only question I've got. I mean, I love it. I do love it, but it could become a morning on the desert island when it grates a bit on me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but come on, it's not exactly one of the later albums, is it? You know, do I hear 21?
Yeah, exactly. Whereas Nick and Miles, I could never get tired of those sounds.
I know you mean, and then we're missing out, of course, so many important albums from that.
We are, but this is, I'm just shooting from the hip here. 70s.
Yeah.
70s. Tangerine Dream Zeit. I'm sure you'd agree with me on that.
That would not be on my list, actually.
What would we pick from 70s?
Actually, what would I pick from that? I mean, because again, that was a decade that, one of the things we're talking about, you know, from the Beatles' evolution in the 60s, and you think of the 70s and the 80s, that the music scene was rapidly evolving with every given year.
The Tony Mansell Singers with the Hilton Airs Swinging in a Winter Wonderland from 1974.
Okay.
Would you agree with that?
Lonnie Liston Smith, Cosmic Echoes. Actually, you know, John Martin, but then I'm thinking, you know, God, John Martin. And I always liked his One World, which was always less fated than Solid Air, but I really like
One World. John Martin, yeah. Should we go with John Martin, One World then? I love that record, yeah.
Okay, let's go with that.
I can't imagine I would get tired of hearing it, let's just say that, yeah. Right, 80s.
Kate Bush, The Dreaming would be up there for me.
I love it. It could grate a bit if you heard it every single day of the rest of your life, couldn't it?
So it could, but then, you know, you always quite like that irritation, that kind of scratching of the scab. Mm.
Colour of Spring, Sign of the Time, Parade.
Parade is astonishing. I love it, yeah.
Mm. Come on, Paul, you must have an idea here. 80s.
Well, I like Tim's idea for The Dreaming. I would probably agree with that.
Let's go with The Dreaming record. Then.
But Hands of Love is also good.
Yeah, I love that. I think The Dreaming I go for, because it's for the reason you're saying, could you play it again and again and again? And one of the things that's kind of interesting here is that my son, who's now 11, when he was about 2, he got into the Beatles. And we just had to play the Beatles for years in the car, on the CD player in the car, you'd be glad to know, Paul. And what was brilliant about this was there was so much detail in the music that it never became tedious. So he, at one point, became quite interested in Kraftwerk, Man Machine. And I have to say, I bored of that after about 10 listens. I kind of felt I'd got, brilliant album, masterpiece, innovative, but I'd got all I was going to get out of it over those 10 listens. Whereas with the Beatles, I was finding new sounds, new approaches, new production techniques. And I think that goes for The Dreaming, that actually The Dreaming would be a great choice in the 1980s because it is so dense and so clever and so detailed.
I love it. I'm happy to go with The Dreaming. That's a good choice. That is a good choice, yeah. Right, 90s. Silence.
Absolutely. So no, there are so many albums. I could, you know, Songs for Drella.
No, I don't want to listen to
John
that.
Cale.
I don't even want to hear that once. I don't even want to hear that once, let alone for the rest of eternity on a
what
desert
an
island.
Album. It's a Material Song is a beautiful album.
I don't want to hear that either.
Scott Walker Tilt, 1995.
Scott Walker Tilt is good. Isn't there a Laughingstock? Laughingstock, come on.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'll give you that.
We can listen to that for the rest of eternity.
Laughingstock, no argument, no fights.
Right.
So we'll have that. Somebody asked a question of 2016, best year for music ever. And strangely, A Moon-Shaped Pool and Bowie's Black Star, I would put in my greatest albums of all time.
Silence. Tumbleweed.
Silence from
Tumbleweed. Yeah.
Oh, Black Star, my God. Because if you're going for the 2010s, if we're not saying Black Star, there's just no debate.
No, I do. I like those records. I like those records.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like those records,
is amazing.
Yeah. 90s, we're going to go for Laughingstock, though, right?
Laughingstock.
2000s. Can we just lump the 2000s all into one decade? Because there's only about 4 albums I've bought since 2000.
All right. Yeah. Well, no, I'm still buying quite a lot, you know, new as well as old. But in terms of older artists, 50 Words for Snow, Black Star, as we say, A Moon-Shaped Pool.
I would put Aerial above.
Oh, Aerial, I love. Yeah, no, I'll go with you on that. I agree with you. Yeah. Fantastic album.
Yeah.
So we've got 2 Miles Davis albums and 2 Kate Bush albums. Is that it? A Talk Talk
and 2
album.
Scott Walker albums as well. Talk Talk.
Oh, that's true. That's true. You can't actually choose Kate Bush again,
no.
Really, can you?
I don't think I want to. I mean, I like Aerial, but I don't think it can't surely be the best album of the 2000s, is it? 21st Century.
I was thinking, oh, God, 1990s as well. The Soft Bulletin, Flaming Lips.
I don't want to hear that.
Put that up there.
No, you're just picking your favourite albums again. You're just picking your favourite.
Right.
Look at the question, Tim. Look at the question. Which albums can you again?
Fantastic production. Okay, you know, all right. What about Thundercat? Do you like him?
I don't know. I'm not familiar. Thundercat. You're going to give me a review now, aren't you?
No, I love. Well, he's the George Duke for our present day. And I mean that in a complimentary way. I like George Duke.
McCartney 3. No, I don't know. What albums have come
out? Actually, Chaos and Creation. Chaos and Creation is a great album.
That is a good record.
I've never heard it. What albums have come out in the 2000s that we both... Come on, Tim. What albums have we both raved about together?
Well, this is a thing that maybe we will get to. We have, because we raved about a lot in 2001, including Kid A and Amnesiac, if we're talking about 21st century albums.
Is there nothing that we both agree that we like in the 21st century apart from Kid A and
Amnesiac? Do you not like Black Star?
No, I do like it. I do like it.
Okay.
What about that album that Sting and Shaggy made together?
Oh, that was brilliant. Actually, I've never heard it, to be honest. Sting, the album I was quite liked by him, was The Soul Cages, which I thought was his most experimental, expansive and heartfelt album.
Tumbleweed again.
Tumbleweed. 1991, Stephen.
Nothing to do with the 2000s.
Nothing to do with the 2000s. Nothing to do with Shaggy.
I can't think of anything in the... There must be loads of... Didn't we do one of the 21st
century
years?
What, Floating Point? You love that, for example. Floating Point.
I do like
that. Sanders.
I do like that.
Sanders, a man in his 80s, still making some beautiful, beautiful music. Leonard Cohen's last album. What an amazing album. What a voice.
Yeah, but the thing is, with a lot of these records, you mentioned, I say, I quite like it. But to listen to it every day for the rest of my life on
Ariel,
a desert
come
island...
Ariel, Ariel, Kate Bush.
Whilst having to look at your fizzog across the other side of the campfire...
It will be both of our physogs deteriorating as the years go by.
Come on, things that we both... Yeah, come on, what do we both like from the 21st century?
100th Window.
Oh, love that album. Oh, yes.
We both thought that was fantastic.
Think you might hit the bullseye there. And I think that's the most underrated album they ever made.
I entirely agree with you. Oh, my God, we found it. Massive Attack, 100th Window.
And I could listen to that over and over again, and I do listen to it quite often. So if you're up for that, I'll go with that one.
Yes. I'll take it.
Massive Attack, 100th Window. Fantastic record. Absolutely fantastic record.
Of course, Tumbleweed here from Paul.
Tumbleweed from Paul.
No, I do know that record, and I agree. It's a great album.
Oh, good.
All right. We've got a consensus here. We've got a consensus. I think that's a fantastic point to wrap things up. A chaotic episode that Tim will be editing all the duff bits out of later on.
I'll be editing all of my errors out and keeping all of yours in, obviously.
Yes, yeah, absolutely, as you normally do, yeah. Okay, so thank you very much, Paul, for joining us. I hope you enjoyed it. I think it was a lot of fun to have you on.
It was a pleasure. Thanks very much for having me. Thank you.
Yeah, and if anybody out there doesn't know Paul's fantastic website, superdeluxeedition.com, it's the place to be these days. It's where all
it
the hip
indeed.
It's where all the hip kids
it's,
are hanging
it's
out.
It's the only place to be, isn't it?
It's where all,
talking. Yeah. I was going to go back to an older question that we were talking about. Whether
oh, for goodness' sake! I'm trying to wrap it up.
I know you're trying to wrap, but this is important in a way. Do younger people like physical? And there have been sort of signs, shoots of recovery. So as I've said, you know, the book, the designs of books, the sales of physical books, up, all good, and certainly in Wells, the great cathedral city in Somerset. I've seen young people in their teens going to the secondhand shop, buying CDs and being excited by it. And one of the things, I only mention it because it was today that my partner's nephew, who is 15, do you know what he wants for Christmas?
No.
An HMV voucher so he can buy some CDs.
Van de Graaff generator box set.
No, an HMV
That was a good reissue
voucher.
From this year, actually. That was a good reissue.
That was a good reissue,
yeah, you're right. Yeah,
But that, an HMV voucher so we can buy CDs. 15.
Well, that sounds very promising. That sounds very promising. Let's hope it becomes more than just a few outliers like that. It becomes a trend, nay, an epidemic. A younger generation rushing to buy CDs.
A pandemic.
A pandemic. Yes. Thank you.
A pandemic of CD purchasing and vinyl purchasing.
Of youngsters buying CDs, listening to this podcast and posting comments on Paul's website.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Fantastic. Thanks, guys. Cheers, Paul. Thanks for coming on, mate.
Thank you.
Merry Christmas.
All right, bye.
Merry Christmas. Bye for now.